In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with financial planner Jonathan Pond. A few years ago, he was asked by a major investment company to take a look at what baby boomers were doing to get ready for retirement. And at the time, and I'm sure that still, in the media, we see stories all the time talking about the fact that baby boomers have done little or nothing, that they're poorly prepared, and that they may indeed be headed for a disaster. Well, he says, contrary to what is often reported, he found that baby boomers were really no worse off than current retirees. In fact, he found that a majority, healthy majority of boomers were in pretty good financial shape. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't still things for them to do, but he says perhaps things aren't quite as bad as they sometimes seem. That's one of the messages that you'll find, along with some practical advice, in his new book, which is titled You Can Do It, The Boomer's Guide to a Great Retirement. The book is out now. It is published by Collins. And if you're interested, I'm certain that you could find it in the bookstore. Also, I do want to mention that Jonathan Pond, his programs have been frequently seen on public television, and he will be appearing in one. As a matter of fact, he'll be actually appearing in our studios. He'll be here on Friday of this week at 8 o'clock in the evening to introduce a television program that is based on or sort of a companion to the book. So if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana or Central Illinois, and you can see our television station, WILL-TV. You can tune in for that program Friday at 8, and whether you can or can't receive WILL-TV, you can certainly take advantage of the advice in the book. You can head down to the bookstore and look for it. Jonathan Pond is joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. I'm sure he would do his best to help you out. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. So we'll save you some money on the call. That is 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Pond, hello.
Hello, David. I'm looking so forward to my visit to your fair city.
Well, we're really pleased that you could be with us. It's always nice to have an opportunity to meet people in person and encourage people to watch our television station. So we're certainly glad that you can participate in this little thing we have going now where we're raising money for our TV station.
Well, exactly. And I hear it's a wonderful university town. My undergraduate work was at a school that had a wonderful university town a few miles south of you guys at Chapel Hill, North Carolina. So I can check off Champaign-Urbana as another one of the great towns that I've had the privilege of visiting.
Just to start out, as you do in the book, I think it's probably worth mentioning that, indeed, a lot of the things that we read about where people, and I am in this category, so I include myself there, are not well prepared. We're either we don't know who we should be talking to, or don't know what we should be doing, or we're paralyzed by those kinds of feelings, and we're never really not doing much of anything. And I think maybe it's worth starting out and talking about the fact that it's not quite as bad as all that.
No, it certainly isn't. You brought up that incident I had a few years ago where I was summarily dismissed from being a spokesperson for one of the biggest financial firms because I had the audacity to suggest that boomers were not going to be eating dog food when they retired. They said, this is not what we want to portray. And I said, well, you massage the data, because I looked at your data, and it shows they're far better off than the current cohort of retirees. And so they showed me the door, and I subsequently heard from a professor that indeed some employees of the big financial services firms had fessed up to him that they were required to massage the data. And I never have been able to understand why anyone thinks that by portraying something as negative is going to have them come in and seek your services. So what I set about doing was first setting the record straight. There is perhaps the most thorough study that has ever been done on boomer preparedness, baby boomer financial preparedness, was out of the University of Wisconsin, and it has been peer-reviewed and is ironclad, and it suggests that 80% of boomers are on track to achieve a good retirement. And only about 2% of the current baby boomer generation will retire in poverty. One reason for that is, I might add, is that Social Security replaces an awful lot of our income these days. I mean, it's not unusual for high-earning couples now to have Social Security checks approximating $1,000 a week. So my sense with the book was not to be Pollyannish and say, oh, you know, you're in great shape, but suggest that you're probably in pretty good shape, but there are some things you can do now to go from a good retirement to a great retirement. And David, I think you're in a big boat where you don't feel confident about about your situation. And what I try to do is focus on things other than the obvious. You know, people don't need to be told they need to pay down their credit card debt. They don't need to be told they should save more. Although, again, our savings rate, despite what you read in the press, is actually quite good. One recent study indicated the average savings rate of boomers in their 50s is about 20%. So it's not really, I'm not portraying an ebullient picture, but I'm saying, you know, you're probably in reasonably good shape. If you're not, I will provide you with some guidance on how to do that as well in the book and in the program.
Just because you mention it, let me ask you a quick question about Social Security, because mm-hmm. over the last couple of years, we have been talking a lot about the future of Social Security. Some people say that we should be worried. Some people say, well, it's not as bad as, again, that's a case where it's not as bad as it sounds. But the standard sort of situation we're presented with is this idea that we know we have this big bunch of people here, the boomers that are getting ready to retire, and we know that the number of workers that following behind them is less. So we have more people drawing, we have fewer people paying in, and there are some people that say, you know, 10, 20, 30 years out, we're going to come to a point where there are more people drawing out than are paying in. And and then some variety of things are suggested that maybe someday we're going to get to the point where the age at which you get a benefit is just going to keep being pushed forward. There may be means testing so that now people who are better off maybe end up getting less. I'm thinking that if some people are relying on Social Security as being a part of their funding for retirement, do they need to be concerned about the fact that sometime in the future, not so much that it won't be there at all, but maybe it won't be what they think it will be?
I spend a considerable amount of ink in the book looking at the alternatives that have been proposed, and basically say, first of all, I've done a fair amount of work in Washington with, perhaps 15, meeting face-to-face with 15 senators and almost a couple hundred members of the House on the Social Security problem. And there's an unwillingness to address it. My feeling, if I were, it is actuarially unsound, but the only way to fix it is with some radical surgery. I mean, significantly radical surgery, because the idea of a means-based test advancing the age of retirement might be a Band-Aid, but it's not. My feeling, David, is that it's not going to affect the boomer cohort. The legislation which gradually raised the retirement age from 65 to 67 for retirees was undertaken decades ago. It wasn't phased in until very recently. So I don't think the boomers have anything to worry about. The only ones that may are the very affluent, who may end up paying more into the Social Security system than they get back, who may find some curtailment of their benefits. But, you know, this is a minefield for the members of Congress, because it's specifically those people, maybe not, you know, the people with hundreds of millions of dollars, but the multimillionaires are the ones that fund these members of Congress campaigns. So it's going to be very, very difficult for them to do anything. And if you want to be very selfish about the issue, you could say that it's more likely to be a problem that our children will have to confront. Hmm. But I say if people want to assume in their retirement planning that Social Security won't be around, more power to them. But most of us can't accumulate the kind of money we'll need to not have to rely on Social Security. To them, I say Social Security will be there. It'll probably it won't be curtailed, and it'll actually be an emolument that is surprisingly high for people.
All right. We have a caller here. Rather than make them wait any longer, we'll get right to him on our line number one, calling here in Champaign-Urbana. Hello.
Well, I'll just comment on two books. One was Eisner, More Social Security, Not Less. They say the projections say that a lot can be covered, but just on this show recently, there was someone talking on Medicare, and that's the real big problem that's growing off the charts. And the TV mentioned some people are retiring overseas because their checks go further. And even recently, they said an HMO is actually sending people overseas and splitting or passing some of the difference on to patients. And the real big problem is the debt for the all the health programs.
A point well taken. The potential problems with Medicare make the Social Security underfunding look trivial. But again, I don't see, other than for the very, very affluent, any significant curtailment. I mean, people scream bloody murder when they raise the retirement age, the normal retirement age, over two years. And the best assumption to make, I think, is that things will continue as they are. But these are enormous problems, and we can only hope for a Congress and an executive branch that has the chutzpah to be able to address them. Mm.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Jonathan Pond. He is someone who has done a lot of speaking, been on television, written a number of books, trying to help people with their financial planning, particularly here we're talking this morning about planning for retirement. He's won a number of awards for his work, including Forbes and Emmy Awards. He's authored a number of books, and they've sold over 1 million copies. He's done a number of programs for PBS, one that will air on our television station, WILL-TV, this Friday at 8, and in fact, he'll be here in our studios to introduce that program. And whether or not you can see our television station, you can take a look at his new book. It's titled You Can Do It, The Boomer's Guide to a Great Retirement. It is published by Collins, which is a division of HarperCollins. And questions here are welcome, too. You have basic questions about retirement planning, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just one kind of basic question that I feel that I should get in here for all of those people who think, well, I've put it off to the point where it's too late. You would say, no, it's never too late.
No, it isn't. One thing I put throughout the book are what I refer to as success stories of people who are late starters, who have undergone any number of adverse events in their lives, and they have turned it around. And there's, if you look at the fact that Social Security is going to replace about 40 to 50% of your income when you retire, and we have some worksheets in the book that will help you decide what it's really going to cost you to retire. My sense is that you can retire in fine fettle with about 65% of your pre-retirement income. And if Social Security is going to provide 45% of that, making up the other 20% doesn't require $1 million or $4 million or whatever else you read about. It requires, it depends. I mean, you know, a couple of $100,000 maybe. That's a lot of money. But you've got time to do so. Another thing that's interesting with respect to boomers is their aversion to retiring early or even at normal retirement age. About two-thirds of them, according to a couple of pretty good studies, want to retire later. And it's not primarily for financial reasons. Boomers are very tied into their careers. And the impact of retiring later on your retirement budget is enormous. One of the examples I cite in the program is a single person who is 62 and wants to retire and will have $31,000 in income. This is a person of average means, $31,000 of income if she retires at 62. I then go out to 68 if she retires at 68, because she doesn't want to retire at 62, but she wants to look at the situation in case she has to. We go out to 68, and she puts a little more money into her retirement savings, has the time to let those retirement savings grow for six more years. At 68, her income, her first year of retirement, rises from $31,000 to $57,000.
Hmm.
That's a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, you put your finger on, I think, one of the issues that people have a hard time thinking about, and that is, how much money am I going to need? And I think that some financial planners would say one of the worst things that can happen to you is if you outlive your money.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want that to happen. Now, how though do you go about, and this may, obviously this is different for every person, and you have to sit
yep.
down and run the numbers for yourself, but is there some kind of thumbnail kind of rule about how do you try to figure out how much money in retirement, how much money coming in, how much income
yeah.
are you going to have?
There's so many variables, and one of the, and maybe this is the CPA coming out in me, but in the book has a number of worksheets and checklists that help you really hone in on that number. The other thing the book has is a companion website, so that the book will never go out of date. And in there are additional worksheets and checklists and what I refer to as decision makers to help people make that decision. I kind of get fixated, and I mentioned it earlier because I've run so many of these, that a couple of $100,000 is enough with Social Security to enjoy an income, a lifetime income, that is going to put you in pretty good stead. But it really runs the gamut, David, as you opined.
Well, let me ask you about one specific thing, and that is mortgage.
Yes.
Because I know that it's something that you talked about, and you talked earlier about the fact that obviously what you want to do is reduce your debt as much as you can.
Yes.
And try to keep your debts low. And that's, of course, good advice for anybody. For a lot of people, probably the biggest thing on the debt side that they're going to have is their mortgage. If you are looking ahead to your retirement and you still have to pay off mortgage on your home, is it your recommendation that one of the things that you should think about is at least by the time that you get there to the point where that you are going to retire, that you would want to have your mortgage paid off?
That is a major point I raise in the book, and I show a variety of really kind of painless ways to reduce the mortgage, so that you're not paying it off when you're 75. There's a major caveat here, David, and that is it's still more important to contribute to retirement savings plans than it is to pay down the mortgage. But if you get into a savings mode where you're putting a goodly amount of money into the retirement plans, look at ways to pay down the mortgage. I mean, if you think about it, if you think about what that does to your retirement budget, if you've paid off the mortgage, and, you know, this is not some unusual condition. The majority of people are mortgage-free when they retire in this country. So this is not a pie-in-the-sky idea. But if you will have paid off the mortgage, that could reduce your retirement budget by 20%, and that can make a dramatic difference in your retirement prospects, no question.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we should talk a little bit about some basic advice about where to put your money.
Yeah.
The problem is you want to maximize return, but you also want to minimize risk. And unfortunately, there's, I guess, a return and risk are inversely proportional. The more risk you're willing to take, the more you might get on your return, but then you're also getting greater risk. So you want to balance those two things.
Exactly. It's a balancing act. And that, again, is another major tenet of the book is, Because most people don't invest very well. There are some studies which I cite in the program, actually, which suggests that investors earn about half of what the index funds generate. Because investors tend to, and I might add, this isn't necessarily if you do it yourself, even if you use an advisor, many of them are inclined to invest their money after stock prices have risen. You know, stocks have risen lately. People can't put enough money into stocks right now when they probably should be maybe lightening up on them a little bit. And conversely, when stock prices are down, stock market's down, they sell. You know, it's completely opposite of what they should be doing. And as a result, they don't make as much. You know, in achieving a good retirement is not just living beneath your means and saving, but it's investing those savings wisely. And we have a variety of suggestions and strategies in the book, including some of these newer types of vehicles which provide you with instant diversification and they rebalance. And these are known as target date funds. You've probably seen them. You may have them in your 401ks or 403bs. Target date fund might say, you know, you want to retire in 2030, you can get a 2030 target date fund. There are also lifestyle funds, which are, you know, typically called aggressive or conservative or moderate, in which you put your money and it's instantly diversified across all of the important investment categories, such as large company stocks, small and mid company stocks, and international stocks and various kinds of bonds. So these can have a huge impact on the investment returns you earn, because as we show in the program, by investing your money smartly, you could literally double the amount of income you take out of those investments when you retire. There's no reason to be average.
I assume that you know, like a lot of investment advisors, you would say that for the average person, the thing that makes most sense is to use mutual funds, and mm-hmm. rather than buying individual issues of whatever it is you're thinking about, and have and if you can invest in a number of funds so that what you're doing is the money is going into different things. If, for example, you're investing in stocks, you want to invest in big companies and middle-sized companies.
That's right.
Smaller companies, and that you can't, an individual just can't do that. So the way obviously you do that is you go and you put your money into a mutual fund, because then
I think
way
mutual
it
funds
out.
Or exchange traded funds are certainly the way, and particularly for categories like small company stocks and international stocks. You know, you don't want to be trading on the Hong Kong stock market. They're ideal for mutual funds. So you can do very well with mutual funds. You can do very well with exchange-traded and or index funds. And again, with exchange-traded funds, you know all you're going to do is average. But since investors generally do about half of average, that's a pretty good emolument.
I think that, you know, there are some people who have the interest and have the expertise and don't mind making the decisions for themselves. A lot of other people who would just say, look, I don't want to have to worry about this. I don't want to have to read the Wall Street Journal every morning to find out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I want to have something where I know it'll be okay, and it'll just do it in an automatic sort of way. And now I think that there are a lot of advisors who suggest various kinds of asset allocations and investment portfolios that will spread out your risk, that will get you in different sectors, or perhaps different, you know, the big companies are small, and suggest what you do is you set it up so money goes in there every month. So you're not trying to time the market. It's steadily going in there and spreading out. Do you have some particular kind of portfolio, that a general purpose portfolio that you like to recommend in terms of your asset allocation?
Sure. I have one of the chapters actually talks about the 60-40% solution, and getting to the issue of doing it yourself or using an advisor. I am agnostic on that. Most people use advisors, and if you find one you know, the best way is through word of mouth recommendation from acquaintances you have whose situation may be similar to yours. That's fine. They can do very well by you. But you have to be careful in using advisors, just like any other professional service. 60% stocks and 40% bonds or interest-earning securities, whatever you want to call them, is has long been shown to be the best way to balance what you said, David, earlier so eloquently, risk and return. And I find that to be a really outstanding way to diversify. Now, that's just part of the game. The second part of the game is, of that 60% in stocks, what kind of stocks? Large company, or when I say stocks, I mean stocks or stock mutual funds. Mm-hmm. Large company, mid-sized company, small company, international. And so you have to spend some time spreading the money around among those categories. And then, and similarly with bonds, you want corporate bonds, you want municipal bonds, you want U.S. government bonds. It's hard to go wrong with that strategy. And this gets back to what I mentioned a little earlier, target date funds, like the 2020 fund, 2015 fund, whatever, and the so-called lifestyle funds, aggressive funds, conservative funds. They do all of that for you. And what I've found, and I'm a pretty cynical guy. I'm as skeptical of the financial services industry of everyone. So in the research I did in the book, I went in with a goodly amount of skepticism on these new kinds of funds, the target date funds and what have you, which are becoming very popular, particularly among employee-based plans like 401ks. And I went in there and tried to pick them apart, and I couldn't do it. They did a good job. They really did a good. They did a good job in diversifying. They did a good job in selecting mutual funds within each of the categories, and they did a good job rebalancing. Now, rebalancing means simply that if, as has happened in the past couple of years, small company stocks have really risen like crazy and large company stocks haven't done very well, periodically you will rebalance. In other words, take a little bit of the money, and the key operative here is a little bit, and take it out of small company stocks and put it into the weaker category, large company stocks. They do a good job. And these things are doing very, very well for investors, far better than the average investor can do. Mm-hmm.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here. Let me just mention once again that our guest is Jonathan Pond. He's won a number of awards for his work as a financial expert, including Forbes and Emmys. His books have sold over 1 million copies. He is the most successful self-help program fundraiser in history at PBS. And maybe for that reason, he's going to be here in Champaign-Urbana at the end of the week on Friday in our studios to help with our fundraiser this winter and also to introduce a television version of this book that we are talking about here, You Can Do It, The Boomer's Guide to a Great Retirement. The book is out now, and certainly you can find it in the bookstore. Collins is the publisher. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. He'll be here, and the program will be on this Friday night of this week at 8 o'clock on WILL-TV. So you can tune in for that. And questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me ask you a question about the relationship between your age and how much money you've got in stocks. Mm-hmm. Some people think that particularly as you get older, that the percentage of your money that goes into stocks should go down. And other, people have this various kinds of rule that says when you take your age and you subtract from 100, and that's how much you should be in stocks, which would indicate that then, you would go down a little bit each year, and that that's, again, for the purpose is to watch out for risk. As you get older, you're wanting to take less and less risk, maybe. Do you think there's something to that?
Well, when I was young and stupid, David, I used to say that. Now I'm older and hopefully less stupid. And the closer you get to retirement, the more conservative you might want to get. But that generally doesn't dictate a major change in your investment strategy. If you've been, you know, chugging along very happily with 75% stocks and 25% bonds, and you're a couple of years from retirement, you might want to reduce that to 70, 30, or something like that, a little bit. The issue is, though, with respect to investments, is how long you're going to need the money. And if you're going to need the money for greater than 10 years, the common, I mean, this is basically a tautological, is that you need to invest for growth. Retirees need to invest for income, certainly, to earn money to pay their bills, but they also need growth. So let's look at the average 65-year-old couple that just retired. They have a last-to-die life expectancy right now of around 27 years. There's a better-than-even chance that one of them will survive to 92. Well, 27 years is a long time. Your cost of living is going to double. And if you invest too conservatively and don't get enough growth, you're going to risk running out of money later on in life. So I have a chapter in the book called What's Different When You Retire, and I start out talking about investing, and I think in answer to the question, I don't have the book in front of me, what's different about your investing when you retire, and I say not much. You can tweak it. If you've been really comfortable with a lot of risk in your investments, you should probably take a little less risk when you retire. But if the money's going to have to last you 20 or 30 years, that you're not going to make it with bonds. You're just not going to make it.
All right. Let's talk with someone here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, hi. Mm-hmm. A longtime listener to Jonathan Pond. I remember when I was a graduate student back in Cambridge, I used to listen when you were on WBUR and WBZ. And
I'll be darned.
And I've taken your lessons wisely all along these last, it's been a long time.
Were you at my school as well, the Harvard? Or
I was at the little math school down the street from there.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's okay. I did a lot of my graduate work there as well, but you can tell an MIT person something, but you can't tell them much.
That's right. So here's my question.
Mm-hmm.
As you look at rebalancing,
yes,
certainly rebalancing to stay targeted on your goals of your portfolio makes a lot of sense. And if
yes.
you do an analysis where you're only looking at sort of what the portfolio looks like as a function of time, it tells you that you should rebalance often and stay close to where you want to be. But now that I've got a bigger portfolio and I also have taxes and a family,
mm-hmm.
There's big tax consequences with rebalancing often or too often. What are your thoughts on rebalancing and thinking about taxes versus sort of revaluing and just sort of retargeting dollars to try and keep the value target to how you'd like to have things apportioned and how to do that in a way that doesn't require as much sort of babysitting as investing in individual
yeah.
stocks?
Excellent question. And by the way, one reason I like these target date funds so much, some of which, by the way, rebalance daily. But as long the one issue is, very frequently you'll find you don't need to rebalance because there's just going to be de minimis changes. You know, if your stock target's 60% and you look at it and it's now 62%, you know, one would argue maybe you don't need to rebalance at that small level. If you do rebalance, the best way to rebalance to avoid adverse tax consequences is to rebalance through your retirement accounts, because their sales and purchases are affected without capital gains taxes owed on any changes therein.
To use those sort of the rebalanced slush fund, so that your overall portfolio is how you want it to be, and while your taxable might be quite out of whack, your retirement funds are making up the balance.
That's right, and another important point this brings up is to make sure you look at your investments in toto. Don't worry about the what each individual account has. I mean, a typical example, some 401k accounts are so rife with stinko funds, holdings, that there are only one or two that are worthwhile. So your 401k fund, for example, might have half the money in small cap and half the money in international. Look at that in isolation, and one would say, well, are you out of your mind? But you can use, you can balance that out through your IRAs or other accounts to make sure you have a sufficiently diversified portfolio. You'll enjoy the section I have in the book on rebalancing, and particularly the illustration I have, which has been relegated to the special reader website, because as you have suggested, it is a non-trivial exercise, and the publisher didn't want to scare the bejeepers out of people when I illustrated how to rebalance. And one last point, which sort of got lost in the details here. You said you have a family. You haven't been listening to me enough, because I've suggested that the real key to financial success is to never take financial responsibility for anything that eats. So you need to revisit those past decisions. But I will leave you with one more remark, my MIT friend, and that is, don't think about changing any commitments you've made. You know, they say marriage may be grand, but divorce is about $100,000.
That's a good one. Well, thanks very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are welcome. We have about 15 minutes left here in Sparta Focus 580 with financial planner Jonathan Pond. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. How does insurance fit into this mix? And particularly, what are your feelings about insurance that has, on the one hand, that simply just pays a death benefit, and the other that has some investment component?
Okay, that's life insurance. Insurance in general. And I must say, and I've insisted on this with all my books, and much to the chagrin of my publishers and editors, and I do have a chapter on insurance, actually combines insurance and estate planning, you know, these very unpleasant things you have to contemplate, like death. So I devote a chapter entitled Expecting the Unexpected. People need insurance. I mean, the biggest risk someone has, a boomer or whatever age, is an uninsured calamity. And the issue with boomers is, you know, boomers are no longer spring chickens. It's not like you can be 20 years old and not have renter's insurance and lose everything you've got in a fire. And, you know, you've got decades to make up for it. Boomers don't have as much time. And one of the issues, there are the particular issues with respect to boomers, as you bring up, is life insurance. Life insurance needs may decline. For some boomers, those that are birthing babies later in life, they may increase. And the issue as to whether you take out term insurance or cash value insurance is really quite simple. If you know the needs are going to go away at some point in the future, term insurance is the cheapest and most cost-effective way to get the coverage. If you've got little kids, if you've got a five-year-old and an eight-year-old, for example, 15-year level term or 20-year level term will work if you figure that if you die after they've finished school, it won't be a big issue with respect to the family. If, on the other hand, you know, the needs may be longer, you may need to provide for a surviving spouse or surviving partner or something like that, you may need cash value insurance. And nothing in your financial life is either or, so it may be a bit of cash value and a bit of term insurance. There's a decision maker in the book that will help you make that decision. The other big issue with respect to boomers is long-term care insurance, sometimes called nursing home insurance. That, again, is a complex area, and what I've endeavored to do with the book, with these complex areas, how much is it going to cost you to retire? When do you want to retire? Where do you want to retire? With those, I have decision makers, and I'm quite pleased with them, because you can go through the checklist and pretty much determine in the illustration of of long-term care insurance, whether it makes sense for you or not.
Mm-hmm. I think that's something that I expect that people are going to at least be talking about, thinking about more and more as we have more people that need that kind of care. And we've perhaps all heard stories about people who, spouses who ended up bankrupt, for example, because everything had to go to the care of their wife or husband, about people who maybe managed to save some money in their lives, but again, went into sheltered care, went through everything they had to go on Medicaid. And I think if you could do something to prevent any of that happening, you'd probably want to do that. Do you think that for a lot of people, having long-term care insurance is going to be something that is going to become part of just a sort of a routine part of financial planning?
I think it will be. And I was a critic of long-term care insurance about a decade ago because the policies were awful and the sales tactics were worse. But I've turned around. The Department of Health and Human Services, I believe it was that federal department, one of them anyway, they said that among the boomers, you know, we're going to live a long time. It's about a 60% chance of needing either nursing home or home health care. It's no longer a question of playing the odds. The odds are pretty strong that you need them. The policy design is better. These policies are often most efficaciously purchased when you're in your 50s. So it's a boomer, it's front and center on the boomer radar, and that, you know, getting into insurance, that gets into another new breed of insurance product that's coming out, and these are these annuities with the decline in pension plans. A lot of boomers are going to enter retirement saying, you know, am I really comfortable taking all that risk with my money and putting it, you know, and investing it on my own and risking maybe running out of money, or should I take out an annuity? Some of these annuities, again, 10 years ago, annuities were a raw deal. But thanks to competition and demand, many insurance companies are now offering some annuities which are inflation-adjusted, which are tied to the performance of the stock market, some of which will protect the principal balance so that you will get income, and when you die, particularly if you die before your expected life expectancy, your family will get the money you put into the annuity. So this is a rapidly evolving and very positively evolving area, and it's another complicating factor that boomers need to confront, but it's not a bad time to be thinking about retirement, because the product design is improved for long-term care and annuities and what have you, and all these wonderful financial products that have come out, like target date funds. So it's good to start thinking about these. You know, another point, David, if I may,
mm-hmm.
And this unfortunately, and I hate to keep quoting studies, but this came out even after I taped the program, so it's not in the book, and it's not in the program, but it's kind of part and parcel of what I want to try to accomplish with the book, and that is that I think it was AARP studied retiree happiness. You know, how happy are you with retirement? And they found that there was a direct relationship between the degree of happiness in retirement and the time spent planning your retirement. One issue with boomers, it's the TGIM generation. Thank goodness it's Monday. They're so tied to their careers. They're scared to death about retirement because of that. And one of my fears is they're not going to plan for it. And believe me, if you don't plan for it ahead of time and you end up retiring, and you may be forced to retire. 40% of the people who retire early do so involuntarily. Health, family problems, losing a job, whatever. If you don't plan ahead for it, and you wake up that morning and you're retired and you don't know what the devil to do, the Grim Reaper is going to come visiting, I think, sooner rather than later.
All right. Well, let's talk with a couple of folks here in the time that we have left. We'll go to someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk just briefly about what entrepreneurs should be doing, people that may not have a retirement program,
mm-hmm.
you know, those kinds of things. Now hang up. Thanks.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, talk about good news. I like to think my book is a good news book. People who are self-employed have plans that are absolutely mind-boggling in their generosity. The thing to start out with is now called a solo 401k or self-employed 401k. You can go to most of the mutual fund websites like Fidelity and Vanguard and what have you, and you can set one up at no cost. The solo 401k allows you to put 100% of the first $15,000 of your income into the plan and deduct it. The only exception to that is if you're age 50 or better, it's $20,000. And then you can put in money on top of that. Suffice it to say, you can put $30,000 or $40,000 away. And for late starters who are self-employed or boomers who eventually sort of get out of their full-time job and get into self-employment, these are great ways to save. Now, there's another vehicle for those who have higher incomes, and that is a defined benefit pension plan. Again, these are mentioned in the book. These are a little more expensive to set up and maintain, but I'll just give you an example. You can put in and deduct as much as $228,000 a year. Now, it would be wonderful to have that kind of income and that kind of discretionary income to put away, but you can put away any amount between zero and that amount and deduct it, and these are tremendous plans, and an awful lot of boomers are beginning to take advantage of them who are self-employed.
All right, well, I hope that is helpful. Let's go to another call here, line number two. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hi, I recently learned another advantage of long-term care insurance is that it can be part of your financial evaluation if you want to buy into a retirement community where you are won't be thrown out if you run out of money but haven't given your money away.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't thought about that another useful aspect of that. If not everybody has access to that sort of choice or necessarily wants it, but it wasn't something I'd heard about before.
It's interesting you bring that up, because one argument against long-term care insurance might be if you expect to go into a continuing care community, because theoretically anyway, you go into a continuing care community, you don't need the coverage because you're buying that coverage in essence. But on the other hand, from the standpoint of the continuing care community, they would love it if you had that coverage. So I can see where it would be a positive from the standpoint of the evaluation. On the other hand, by the time you get into a continuing care community, one issue with long-term care is health problems intervening, which preclude your qualifying for a policy. And if the decision to go into a continuing care community, which is usually made in the mid or late 70s of age, is something you're thinking about, the question becomes, along the way, do you need the long-term care insurance? You probably do. But it begs the issue as to whether or not, with a continuing care community, it could be dropped. Because, boy, the combination of long-term care insurance plus the lofty monthly payments in a continuing care community require a princely sum of money.
Well, I think it, too, it depends on your age and your particular financial status.
That's correct.
I'm sure that it varies quite a bit. And whether you're going into a for-profit or not-for-profit situation.
Yeah.
But I just mentioned that as something that's of we have a nonprofit, excellent multi-layered care. I guess you call it continuing care facility in Clark Lindsay here in Champaign Urbana, and because it's of our community, we probably have a number of people who might be on the borderline, not sure if they would qualify, and having long-term care insurance can make a difference.
Could be. But on the other hand, if they've been able to afford the long-term care policy along the way, you're right. You're right. They still may be borderline from the standpoint of qualification.
Yeah.
I can't say enough about continuing care communities, having parents who have had a very good experience with them. I think they're just wonderful, particularly if the kids are far flung, and it's comforting for all generations.
Well, one of the things I've learned about these is that it's useful if you don't wait until it's an emergency.
That's right.
For a couple of reasons. One is you get to make your own choice. Two is you don't have to settle for what beds are available. And three is you can adapt to a community and develop friendships, et cetera, while you are mobile and able. And in the case of Clark Lindsay, to get into an apartment, you have to be able to function independently to start with.
That's right.
And it's really interesting to see the vibrant community that is in that particular place. And we have I have a mother-in-law who's in her 90s, who we waited until she was nearly borderline in terms of able to function independently.
Yeah.
And the fact that she's in a multi-level care facility has made it much easier to move her within the community as she has needed more care.
Yeah, they're peace of mind. Really, it really does help.
I'm going to have to jump in here. I appreciate the comments of the caller, but we're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. I want to mention one more time that if you're interested in some good basic advice on planning for retirement, you might look for the book that we've mentioned that our guest, Jonathan Pond, has authored. The title is You Can Do It, The Boomer's Guide to a Great Retirement, published by Collins, which is a division of HarperCollins. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore. Also, if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana or Central Illinois, you can watch our television station, WILL-TV. There's a television version of this that we will show this Friday evening at 8 o'clock on WILL-TV. And Jonathan Pond will be here in our studios to introduce the program. So we certainly appreciate you giving us time this morning and the fact that you're going to be here at the end of the week. We appreciate that very much, too.
Well, I look forward to it, and thank you for such a stimulating discussion. Mm-hmm. I hope the listeners felt the same.
I appreciate it.